I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On the road from Iowa to the New Hampshire primary, the aha revelation is that the grumpy grandpa has the youth vote. 20-somethings for the 74-year-old, in big numbers and high energy, driven by need and anxiety as much as their own idealism. The other epiphanies are that the youth bloc anticipated his drive to detoxify the word socialism and to rethink what's realistic, what's viable, in a time of deep discontent. Also, that the Bernie Sanders fresh young army could shake, if not shatter, the anointed air around Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. This hour, the What's the Matter with Kansas writer Thomas Frank has an acerbic take on the Democrats as a class party. He doesn't mean the working class in pain. And the HBO dramatist of The Wire, Tremé, and Show Me a Hero, David Simon, is back to reflect on when and why excess workers got abandoned in the free-for-all of politics. But first, a taste of the outlook among students who left Tufts, MIT, and Harvard on a bus late on the night of the Iowa caucuses, just in time to meet Bernie Sanders arriving in Manchester, New Hampshire at 4 o'clock on Tuesday morning this week.
I come from an immigrant family, and everywhere else in the world, socialism does not have the connotations that it has here. I guess to me it means a basic premise of equality.
So when I hear people kind of balk at socialism, like it's the McCarthy era, I kind of tend to want to ask them, like, what do you think about public schools? What do you think about public transportation? Like, what do you think about the roads you drive on? If we believe that healthcare is a human right, if housing is a human right, then why shouldn't the government have some role in fixing the imperfections of our economy where those rights are not a reality for some people?
I think after the recession, a lot of us saw firsthand the effects of unfettered capitalism. And when people's parents lost their houses and jobs, when kids had to transfer schools, that was sort of a tipping point for a lot of people.
I come from New Hampshire, and I love my country. I love America, and I do believe that it is the greatest country the world has ever seen. But that doesn't mean we can't learn from other countries. Just because LeBron James is the best player in the NBA, he can still see Steph Curry's shooting ability, his ability to create open shots, and learn from that.
Thomas Frank's forthcoming book is titled Listen, Liberal, but what he sees as the 30-40-year sacrifice of the soul of the Democratic Party. I asked him to fit the photo finish in Iowa of what wasn't supposed to be a contest into his narrative of the modern Democrats.
On the one hand, it's a really remarkable thing that Bernie Sanders was able to do that. I mean, this is a man with a Brooklyn accent, you know, going around in Iowa and reaching these people. In conventional political terms, it's shocking.
Tom, the margin, especially among young voters, is astonishing. Something like 7-8-1 for Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. When we talk about inequality, there's all these different ways of evaluating it. One of the most shocking is the generational inequality. These are the new proletariat, and they know it. You know, the combination of student loans and the casualization of labor.
Yep.
These are people who are really on the receiving end of the economy. And what do the Democrats have to say to people like this? It's like, well, too bad. You know, that's inevitable. That's globalization, or that's technology, or something like that. You know, that's not the Democrats I know. Of course, it's the Democrats. I know it's not the Democrats of 50 and 60 years ago, you know, who would have stood up for these people. And so they have every right in the world to be furious. Okay, I'm quite serious about that. And it's a refreshing thing to see them flocking to Bernie. But it's also, it's not idealism per se. I mean, there is a lot of idealism whenever you get behind a guy like Bernie Sanders. But these are people who are, at the end of the day, these people are screwed, and they know it, and they are reaching out for someone who promises to unscrew them. You know, that's what he's saying.
Tom Frank, I'm fascinated by the words whose meaning has changed or which are now sort of up for battle, including socialism. The poison seems to have gone out of that word. But the question now of what's viable, what's possible, what's realistic, what is electable, and what values we attach to those different kinds of things.
For starters, Bernie Sanders is not a socialist in the kind of 19th century sense of the word. He's what they call a gas and water socialist, you know, municipal socialism, which is really not that far out of the American mainstream. He's a New Dealer. In earlier times, he would have just been described as a Democrat.
Yeah. Speak, Tom, as the great diagnostician of the good guy party that has had a hand in making everything worse, including the export of jobs, inequality, the decline of the middle class. I mean, specifically, what is the Iowa message from this dead heat?
Think of what you just said, the good guy party that's made everything worse. The party of the good guys that has nevertheless seen inequality go skyrocketing, that basically accomplished all of the things that Reagan wanted to do when he was president, you know, all the deregulations, the mass imprisonment. I mean, you think about the Democrats in the grand scheme of things, when you see inequality spiraling out of control in the way that it is, why haven't they been more aggressive on that front? When I was young, this would have been their number one priority. You know, they were the party that was dedicated to defending a strong middle class. It's not just who they were. That was the soul of the Democratic Party. They talked about it constantly. You know, their identification with the New Deal, with Franklin Roosevelt, with middle class America, I mean, that's all there was to them. If they don't have that anymore, who are they?
You put the question in my mind because you described them as the smart, satisfied, prosperous, professional class, almost presiding over the ruination of their old base.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what my new book is about. It finally occurred to me that we just have the story wrong, that that's just not the core Democratic constituency anymore. That's not who they care the most about. And the answer is right there in plain sight if we open our eyes and look. I mean, they talk about it themselves. Who is their core constituency these days? It's satisfied, successful professionals, members of the upper stratum of the professional class. And they themselves will actually say this when they're talking about their demographic appeal. That's one of the sort of main props of the party. They're quite open about it. And this is the one group that basically gets everything they want from the Democratic Party. They're very satisfied with the Democratic Party, that thinks Hillary Clinton is a great presidential candidate, that looks at the Obama years with profound satisfaction, you know, a little frustration at these Republicans who were so obstructionist in Congress. But that's the group. And if you look at them from that perspective, the Democrats as a class party, but the class in question is not the working class. It's not Roosevelt's people. It's not the middle class, you know, Harry Truman's people or Lyndon Johnson's people. It's the professional class, Bill Clinton's people.
Translate that dead heat and the incredible margins among young people into instructions to the Democratic Party. What are the new marching orders?
The Democratic Party's at a turning point. They're not going to turn. I mean, the turning point actually came 8 years ago, the financial crisis. Yeah. You had Barack Obama stepping up, and we all thought that, or people like me anyway, thought that he was the one that would lead the Democratic Party away from its former self, the sort of Clinton-esque Democratic Party that has come up, you know, over the years and is so friendly with Wall Street and friendly with the establishment in so many ways. You know, we came to the turning point and we didn't turn. And people know it now. They're desperate. I mean, we're going into this era of inequality, and it is now undeniable. And it's extremely unpleasant to be on the receiving end of this new economic arrangement. I don't know. Look, the Democrats are profoundly satisfied with themselves and who they are. And they think they've got the electoral system in a lock. They think they're going to win the presidency no matter what because of the changing demographics of the country. So in their mind, there is no crisis. There's nothing to worry about. They don't have to do anything different. They have a phrase for it. They call it the coalition of the ascendant. They think it is bulletproof. So whoever they nominate is going to win the presidency is what they think. Unless it's Bernie Sanders, of course, because the same people who make this argument are passionately pro-Hillary, of course.
What are they going to do after Iowa? They've been served notice of something.
So she has such an enormous advantage over him. It's hard to see, even if his insurgency catches fire, and I think it will, as these things often do. And, you know, she's a fighter. She's got the greatest fake populist in history at her side, by which I mean her husband, Bill Clinton. They've got enormous resources. They have friends in every state. Every elected Democratic official is on their side, just about. It's hard to see how Bernie beats her, even though he is going strong right now.
But the young disadvantaged voters in Iowa are pounding the table. Pay attention.
Yes, that's right.
You're not suggesting that they can ignore them.
I'm not convincing of this. Let me put it this way. They would rather lose than change the way they do things. Basically, to make a very long story short, the Democrats love to moan about the Koch brothers and the hierarchy of money and the 1%, you know, and how dreadful this is. And after doing all this research on the Democratic Party, it dawned on me it's not the 1%. It's the 10%. It's the upper stratum of the professional class that is the mass constituency for inequality. You know, whenever you look about who's done well in the last 20, 30 years, it's not just the 1%. It's the upper 10%. And probably a majority of those people are Democrats. There's a mass constituency for inequality in the Democratic Party. They have no problem with it. The people in the leadership of the Democratic Party, they think inequality is sad. They think it's kind of tragic that we've lost that middle-class world of the 50s and 60s and 70s. There's nothing you can do about that.
Right, right. The economy just doesn't need those people. Even our own prosperity doesn't need those people anymore.
Exactly. It's a shame, but no, the economy doesn't need those people anymore, and it's just too bad. It's complete hogwash. You see what I'm getting at here? Inevitability and practicality is always a mask for something else, for, you know, for someone's own class interest. They want the TPP to be – it's not – God didn't write the TPP, right? American trade associations wrote the TPP. They sat down and negotiated this thing. One of the most interesting things in my history of the Democratic Party is the way they use this word change. It has two meanings in the Democratic Party. One is the Barack Obama meaning, the hopeful meaning. We can, you know, change this. You know, remember change.gov?
That hopey changey thing, yeah.
The other meaning is the one that Bill Clinton liked to use. Change is sweeping through our country. Change is bringing us this. Change is happening to your town. Change is happening to your industry. And the two meanings of the word are completely the opposite of one another. And it's up to us to choose which one we think is right. The Obama definition is the one that I'm partial to, that we can change the system and the situation. This is a democracy. This is America.
That was Thomas Frank, who made his name explaining why his native Kansas went conservative at the price of its prosperity. Coming up, the new meanings of a forbidden word in the American discourse, with young writers who recoined socialism for themselves and these times. This is Open Source. The question is how the upstart Democratic socialist Bernie Sanders pulled off a near tie in the Iowa caucuses with Hillary Clinton, the inevitable nominee, people said, and some still say, for the Democratic presidential nomination. Our guests live this hour are the writer and activist Sarah Leonard, who co-edited The Future We Want, a sort of manual of radical ideas for the new century. With us in the Boston studio, Corey Peterson-Smith, a graduate student and political organizer based in Dorchester, and Tim Barker, PhD candidate in history, who wrote an essay in Sarah's book. Sarah, the book is fresh. It's clear. Introducing socialist ideas to 25-year-olds who never knew the Cold War or the curse on that S word. It, in your usage, it doesn't mean public ownership of the means of production. But what does it mean?
Well, it might mean that. But in the current context...
Wait a second. Are you taking over the auto industry again or what?
Well, probably not tomorrow. No, I don't think so. I do think in any case, it's good for workers to have a say in their workplace. And you can debate how much of a say people should get. But everybody's happier when they're not purely bossed around and have no control over their day-to-day life. And we started putting the book together actually well before Bernie Sanders decided to run for office. And we started putting it together because we felt that young people were developing a somewhat more radical critique of the existing system than young people had had in recent years. You saw that really break out around Occupy, but certainly more recently around Black Lives Matter. This is a generation that saw the crash. A lot of kids had gone to college like they thought they were supposed to, and then realized they still didn't have a job. They were still screwed. And this generation that saw the crash was also the post-1989 generation. So the idea of socialism both means something kind of vague to this generation and isn't scary. And so there's an opening in a way to open up the American political imagination and think, are the same ideas that we've been served for the last couple decades really getting us where we want to go? And if not, could we consider this crazy thing called socialism?
Sarah, Bernie calls it democratic socialism. The writer I love, the late Tony Judt, called it social democracy, meaning the post-war bargain in Europe. And it echoes here between a capitalist economy and public guarantees of housing, public health, education, even through graduate school. Is it the same? And how in the world does Bernie pay for it? Is it as expensive as people think? I mean, let's get real about enacting something.
Sure. Well, parsing the differences between democratic socialism and social democracy could take us all week, or the decades it has taken many people to write books on it. But we could say that social democracy, which does not involve, as you were saying, taking over the means of production, but is really the sort of simple social bargain we know in most of Western Europe, would be a major step forward for the U.S. And if you want to talk about paying for it, a really good example is healthcare. So a lot of people have said, and this is sort of a common part of the debate, yeah, sure, single payer would be nice, but how could we possibly afford to do that? And in fact, we know not only lefties say this, but really mainstream commentators like Ezra Klein have said this as well, that actually single payer is a lot less expensive. You cut down massively on administrative costs. You're in a much better position to bargain with drug companies and to regulate what they're allowed to charge. And actually, you bring the cost down quite a lot for a service that everybody needs. And so I think it's a bit of a myth that has been propagated for reasons we can guess that, you know, the government running certain services that everybody needs is this crazy, expensive, bureaucratic idea, when in fact most Americans know that there's nothing more expensive and bureaucratic than the healthcare system we have right now, which is a total catastrophe. It's better with Obamacare, but it hasn't been made easy.
Stand by, Sarah. Tim Barker, you're the historian on the air tonight. The eternal question in American history, certainly the last century, has been why is there no socialist movement, socialist party? Is it in the water? Is it in the ground? Is it in our heads? What's changed and how would you prove it?
Yeah, I mean, so one answer that socialists like to make to that question is that, in fact, there has been a socialist movement in this country at different times that's been, you know, pretty significant. You can think of Eugene
Vigil. My parents voted for Norman Thomas, sure.
Norman Thomas, sure. And even more famous than Norman Thomas is his predecessor as the leader of the Socialist Party, Eugene Victor Debs, who more than once got 1 million votes, including from a prison cell. And Debs' Socialist Party managed to elect people to the, you know, the Federal House of Representatives. So that's one answer, but it's true that we don't have a socialist or labor party that is explicitly a working class organ the way that you have in most other parts of the world, especially in Western Europe. And there have been a lot of answers provided for that. I think the most important one is the strength of racism and white supremacy in the United States, including among the working class, racism dividing the working class, but mostly as a strategy of the ruling class. So for most of the 20th century, you had the Republican Party speaking for business and the Democratic Party sort of strangled by Southern Democrats, to whom it was very important to keep a lid on any kind of labor unrest, any kind of independent organizing. So when you look at the sort of closest that people came in the United States to achieving Western European social democracy, I'm thinking particularly of the sort of height of the New Deal liberal energy after the Second World War, it was really the fear, the anxiety of Southern Democrats who had a stranglehold in Congress, which passed the Taft-Hartley Act, you know, which put a brake on union organizing, which stopped the CIO from organizing in the South. So I think that's the most important fact I can point to.
That's a lot. And suddenly we have this sort of spontaneous generation that Sarah's speaking of, and then Bernie thinks, hey, I'll run as a socialist. And meantime, shock to me, in the Wall Street Journal last weekend, Peggy Noonan, darling of the sort of smart Republican world, says on the strength of one rally in Sanders' rally, she said, this is true. This is happening. And, you know, people are high and dry since the meltdown in 08. Nobody's explained it. Nobody's apologized. High and dry as we watch inequality helplessly sort of spike. Can we believe this? I mean,
yeah. I mean, I think,
and what about when the it gets swift voted by the Republican ad campaign in a presidential campaign?
Yeah, I mean, to answer your first question, I think Noonan is right. People are really anxious and looking for answers, and that's why it's really important that we develop a good answer. I think Sanders, whatever you think of his politics, is providing socialists an opportunity to sort of start to forge a common political language that stresses solidarity, that stresses making things better for working people. Because if we don't do that, people's response to this crisis and the anxiety is going to be something we don't like. And we already see that in the Republican primary. We need something positive to counter that with. We need a universal solution to the crisis. To your swift voting question, I think, you know, let them try. And it'll be a reflection on how strong the movement is and how strong organizing is when we see that it doesn't work. You know, some of these attacks will fall flat.
Corey, I'm dying to hear your take on the future, but I want to know how you found socialism, where it found you. And it was this another spontaneous generation in your mind?
Well, for me, socialism was a conclusion after just coming into an understanding of a world of inequality. And for me, it actually started by learning about the Palestinians this group of people who are oppressed and also demonized. And I had heard that these people were terrorists in the media, but I didn't hear about the kind of injustice that they're subject to. And when I did, I thought, wow, I had no idea that this oppression existed. What else don't I know about? And that opened up a whole kind of political experience for me, in which I became an activist and ultimately learned about the social democratic policies in Canada regarding universal health care. And I said, oh, well, we should have that in the United States. There are so many uninsured people. I want that. And then somebody said, well, that's a socialist program. And I said, well, then I'm a socialist. Now,
what are you hearing and observing in the Sanders campaign?
In the Sanders campaign?
And on the street where you live, Codman Square, Dorchester.
Yeah. Well, what Sanders is talking about is things like student debt, the debt crisis. He's talking about the healthcare crisis. And to be clear, for me now, socialism means something well beyond those things. But Sanders is giving voice to a lot of bitterness that I think has resulted from the dashed hopes of life under the Obama administration. People were really hopeful that things would change. And in fact, the people who wrecked the world economy are doing better now than they were doing in 2008. The U.S. is involved in more wars now than it was in 2008. And so I think there's a general frustration and bitterness. And Bernie Sanders is speaking to that. And I agree with Tim that what the caucus in Iowa has opened up is a situation where socialism, long considered to be this thing that has no place in the mainstream U.S., but really is part of the mainstream of just about every other country in the world politically. Now, there's a new opportunity to talk about socialism. And my problem is that socialism is the right word, but the Democrats are the wrong party to be a vehicle to actually advance it.
Why so? And would you say even if Bernie Sanders won the nomination?
Even if you want, yeah. I mean, this party, you know, every 4 years we're asked to kind of imagine how terrible, if you're a progressive, if you're on the left, you're asked to imagine how terrible a Republican administration would be and how wonderful a Democratic administration would be. Well, we don't have to imagine. We've been living under 7 years of a Democratic administration, which has included a time when the Democrats controlled Congress as well. And look at Flint, Michigan. I mean, when Hurricane Katrina happened, people rightly were outraged. They blame Bush because he's a Republican. Well, this crisis is in its second year in Flint, and nobody is being held accountable, just like nobody was held accountable for the Wall Street disaster or anything like that. So this is the party that has presided over those things. And I don't see how Bernie Sanders, you know, even if he achieves some success in the party, how that can turn the whole tide of this party.
Sarah and Tim and Corey, speak to this. You mentioned the student debt crisis. It's more than $1 trillion, and it's an awful burden, not just on people, but on the economy, on the future, on everything. Hillary Clinton has paid serious attention to it. How would a socialist approach to that political, economic riddle and terrible problem. How would it differ from hers? Sarah, well, maybe?
One of the notable things that Sanders and Clinton debated was exactly this question. And I thought a notable difference was that Hillary Clinton said, we should not have tuition-free college because students should have, quote, skin in the game. And I thought that was a somewhat distressing metaphor, since a lot of students right now are so burdened by debt that they're having to give up basic necessities. And we saw a lot more talk about this around Occupy, though it was very central to that particular moment. But the debt has gotten extreme. And so to suggest that people need skin in the game seems to misunderstand the way we should think about education, which is as a public good. Everyone should have a right to an education. And I believe Sanders has made this point himself, but you know, for a long time in this country, we've considered K through 12 education to be a right because everyone should be literate. Everyone should be able to participate in our democracy. And today, a college degree is the equivalent of what a high school degree used to be, given the way that our economy has tilted now towards the knowledge economy. It's ridiculous to think that being able to get through college should not be a public good. And Sanders has suggested that we have tuition-free college for those who need it, for anyone who can get in, anyone who is committed to finishing college. And that's a sort of basic commitment that many other countries have.
I was going to say, I mean, German students,
German students have population.
German students have skin in the game, and they're going to school for free. And it's good for their economy, too. Tim Barker, it's your turn.
On the college question, I would absolutely echo Sarah. I think it's the difference between making something a right and, you know, seeing something as the sort of thing we want to have. You know, we wish we could have it. Maybe we'll work out a really complicated set of subsidies to get it. You know, it sounds like a minor difference, but it's really a fundamental difference in philosophy of whether the market should rule every aspect of life or whether there are things like health and education that are so important that they really shouldn't be commodities. And I think, you know, education is a great issue for socialists because there are already so much federal money involved. You know, a lot of these loans, including loans paying for people to go to really terrible for-profit schools, are federally guaranteed. So there's a huge boondoggle, tons of federal money being spent on this, and it's going straight into the pockets of completely unscrupulous, you know, charlatans running these for-profit schools. So the socialist approach isn't just to trim around the edges. It's to say that we've been looking at this wrong. This isn't a thing where someone clever and shameless should be able to make money. This is a thing that should be a right, the way that it's a right, you know, to be able to go out and speak your mind. It should be a right to be able to develop your mind and to develop your capabilities just by virtue of being a person.
The political crunch in this campaign around Black Lives Matter hasn't really ripened yet or hasn't happened. How would a socialist approach to race, criminal justice, Flint, Michigan, how would that differ from a standard even New Deal or Democratic Party approach, Corey?
Right. Well, socialists are for Black liberation, and the starting point is a recognition that Black people have been systematically held down in this country from the foundation of the country in the days of slavery, and therefore there needs to be a systematic remedy. I mean, it has to be said that a lot of things that will uplift Black people are things that will uplift the whole working class. I mean, The crisis in Flint is really the culmination of years of deregulation and cost cutting and this idea of small government. If you get rid of that, that will actually benefit everybody. But there do need to be special provisions meant to redress the centuries-old oppression of Black people. So,
specifically, how? I mean, that we're talking reparations of some sort. What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean there should be reparations. Absolutely. We should end mass incarceration. That's the United States locks up more people than any other country in the world. The police departments across the country should be defunded. Obviously, there's this enormous crisis where the cops are killing Black people with total impunity. So those are some of the things that need to change. But things like affirmative action that used to be institutional remedies meant to address racism, things that we've lost, we need to go back to.
Sarah Leonard, would you give a short description of the socialist program, Nuevo Socialism, in education, K through PhD?
Well, I think we would certainly have tuition-free education, that anyone who wants an education can get one, that education is a public good. On the K-12 level, one of the biggest struggles we've seen in the last several years is over public education as we've known it versus charter schools and the breaking of teachers' unions. This had been really dramatically played out in Chicago, where you have a sort of Clintonite Democrat, Rahm Emanuel, who has been really waging war on the teachers' union there. And the teachers' union there is a little bit more militant than the teachers' unions in most places, very well organized and deeply grounded in the community. And so when the teachers in Chicago went on strike, the entire community really supported them, and you saw a much bigger, more prolonged struggle in Chicago than you've seen in other places. And so for us, a really important part of thinking about education is making sure that teachers are unionized, because what that means is you are fighting for the resources that the schools need. And we think that certain basic things that have been cut in recent years are totally crucial. So,
Sarah, hold it there. We're coming back. We're talking about the vibes out of Iowa on the way to New Hampshire. Coming up, David Simon, a legend for The Wire out of Baltimore, has more on 40 years of lost ground in the American project. This is Open Source. David Simon is the great contemporary dramatist of city life in 21st century America. In television series that began with five seasons of The Wire on the drug war in Baltimore. His last was Show Me a Hero, about a political war over public housing in Yonkers outside New York City. He paused with us the other day over the sorry fate of Flint, Michigan, a city that would make for one more great Grim Simon inquiry. It's a community that has suffered gruesomely from lead poisoning, all for want of public water treatment that would have cost the city about $100 a day.
Government's not a business, is it? If it was a business, they'd call it a business. They'd put an ink at the end of it. There'd be corporate officers. They'd report their profits quarterly. They'd go to Wall Street. There's a reason they call it a government. And the reason is that not everything the government needs to do and is responsible for doing, in fact, the things it's most responsible for doing, are not profitable and not supposed to be profitable. And the misconstruing of the act of governance as being a financial dynamic is one of the most corrupting things in our society right now. And you see it with, you know, for-profit prisons. You know, if there's nothing more insane than that, the idea that we're going to have a product called incarceration. And companies that do this for profit are going to go to Wall Street and say, we can give you 3% growth over the next year. Wait, you're selling prison sentences to people and you're promising growth? Isn't that a societal failure? Don't we want to have less people in prison? Obviously, in order to do it, they had to like extend incarceration to petty criminals and people who were nonviolent drug offenders and pre-detention of illegal immigrants. And they couldn't find enough honest criminals. They had to make more Americans into criminals in order to guarantee that to Wall Street. I mean, it's astonishing. And yet we bought it. So given what we just did with the drug war, do you think some schnook who's trying to pretend he's running a business rather than a government in Michigan is going to make sure that people in some town where not a lot of his voter base is are drinking good water or bad, that he's going to look upon that as his first priority? Of course it happened. It's going to happen time and again, as long as we keep mistaking government for a for-profit entity.
Strikes me this Flint also puts the whole austerity idea in the dock. I mean, when you're pinching and cutting and trimming here and there as an economic fiscal remedy or something, and bang, it's taking people's lives. It's insane.
This is the horror of capitalism, of unrestrained market capitalism without regard to a social framework, which is, and I'm saying this cynically, do we need those people in Flint? What's the big deal if they get poisoned? I mean, I'm just asking economically. I'm not asking morally. Morally, I know we need them. Morally, I know that if I degrade my neighbor's life and devalue his life, my own is devalued. I know these things morally. But from a purely capitalistic notion, we don't have the auto factories that used to be relevant in Flint economically. We don't need those people. There's no assembly line for them. They're extra people. They're not trained for anything but a manufacturing base that is generations gone. Those factories are on the Pacific Rim or in Mexico or non-unionized in the South. We don't need them. Are you arguing morality to the market? The market's not listening.
That was part of the gift of The Wire. I mean, the flat-out statement that these are people that our economy and our powers don't need anymore.
We've shrugged them off.
Right.
We've shrugged them off. You know, this country worked briefly as a capitalistic society. It was because there was an element of socialism ingrained in the middle of the 20th century, and labor and capital had to fight it out. And neither labor nor capital was able to win a complete victory over the other. And in that tension, we built the middle class and we built the greatest consumer economy the world has ever seen, where, you know, average families had incredible amounts of discretionary income. Since 1980, we've been disassembling that. We've been disassembling that as fast as we can.
David, you're speaking of common causes, common good, common country, or something.
Right, and we've always choked on race. That's, you know, the thing Charlie Murphy and Tammany discovered when they switched sides after the Triangle Fire in New York. And they said, you know what, all these Irish and all these Italian and all these Jews and everybody that's coming into the city, that's the people we're going to side with. You know, the new voters, we're going to make them Democratic voters. We're going to have a coalition. We're going to basically have a big tent, and, you know, working class politics can be made to work. And that worked for a long period of time. It worked until exactly the moment that the next group of immigrants that they needed to absorb had black skin and were coming up from the South. Then the Democratic coalition logic of politics choked on itself. And nobody could make that leap because race is such a profound pathology in American life.
Maybe that's the growth assignment for Bernie. I mean, to recognize that it's not all class and economic categories. We have choked on race over and over again.
It's both things. I mean, you see it in just how much more frightened and how much more irrational our law enforcement behaves with regard to a car stop on an African-American or you know, a perceived threat in a given situation. I mean, the numbers don't lie. I mean, and at the same time, the truth is we're quite comfortable discarding a lot of white people, too, now that we don't need a working class in the same numbers that we once did. And the drug war went on as long as it had. It got another boost of authority because it started chewing up white people, you know, out in the West with methamphetamine. And so, like, a lot of this is class and a lot of it's race. Where one ends and the other begins, it's almost not worth arguing about.
Absolutely not.
You know, I think they're both true. If you think it's only race, you're not paying attention. And if you think it's only class, you're not paying attention.
Quick question. After Obama, what would a healing president look like?
I don't think there is one. I don't think there is one. You know, I don't think the presidency's broken. I really don't. I very much admire this president. And I think he's done about as well as you can do with a government that is systemically broken at the legislative branch, which is to say the part that you can purchase. The populist sentiment in America can still prevail when it's the mass of the country voting. You know, it has a decent chance of prevailing in a nationwide election. But the balkanization that capital has achieved with the legislative branch and done so just to keep it from doing anything to the societal benefit is so remarkable and so complete that if you get in and you try to be utilitarian in any way, no matter who you are, Republican or Democrat, I think the money's going to come after you so that no wound can be cauterized. It's going to fight like hell to maximize profit.
That was somber David Simon of all those HBO hits since The Wire. He was speaking of what's a very old habit by now to put profits first and, you know, say a little prayer that there will be something left over for public necessities. Feels like a 30-year re-education process ahead, Sarah. Who's going to teach us? And let me introduce our live committee on the new socialism, with or without Bernie Sanders. Who's going to lead the way? And it's got to go wide and deep, I would think, Sarah.
Oh, no doubt. I think a really interesting thing that we're seeing right now and quite exciting is a new generation actually getting organized. One of the many problems with the total collapse of the labor movement and the left since the late 1970s is we actually lost all of the institutions that were whose job it was to educate people and to teach people how to organize and how to think critically about our politics. And so right now, a lot of people have blamed the millennial generation for being disorganized, for making a fetish of horizontalism and so forth. But what we're actually seeing is a group of people who have not had any of those institutions at their disposal, have had very little training in organizing, sort of getting themselves together and becoming a force. And I think right now we're seeing that most clearly actually in the Black Lives Matter movement, which has been doing not only impressive organizing, but a ton of education. And you've seen a lot of the leaders of that movement make their names on Twitter, and people like to make fun of that. And sure, it's, you know, organizing is not Twitter alone. But what they're doing is talking a lot about the experience of being Black in America, of grappling with law enforcement, of losing loved ones. And that's an education that white America needs and should not be separate from. And not only that, they've used their platforms to get in the candidates' faces. And I think this has been really, really impressive. They've found ways of interrupting them to use Bernie Sanders' rising popularity, for example, as a platform for the Black Lives Matter movement to get in there and say, oh, yeah, you want to say you represent progressives, you want to represent leftists. Well, you need to think really hard about criminal justice and race. As David Simon was saying, it's not enough to think about class. And Bernie Sanders knows that, but does he know it? And these young people are performing that educative function that you're talking about. And I think that's what we need to be looking to as we try to figure out what sort of world we want to create.
Does Bernie Sanders know, do you know, Sarah, how hard, tooth and nail, people are going to fight for the tax privileges they've accumulated, racked up steadily, both kinds of administrations over the last 30, 40 years? I mean, that's going to be bloody in the streets, I would think. It ought to be.
Oh, yeah. It's totally terrifying. I mean, the thing to recognize is it's already blood in the streets. Exactly. Right now, it's just that, you know, corporate America is pummeling the rest of America. And when I say blood in the streets, I mean people don't have health care and they're dying. I mean, our infant mortality rate is higher than anywhere in Western Europe. And that's a choice we've made. Although perhaps that's a little strong, it's a choice some of us have made. There is a famous Princeton study recently. It became famous very quickly.
We know that man, sure. The non-contact between popular preference and the people who run the government.
Exactly. And so we are seeing a very top-down battle right now. And it's certainly not going to be easy to push back the other way. But as ever, for the left, we have to believe that the numbers are on our side. So it's a question of organizing people. And that's why what we're looking at right now is actually so encouraging. You can only push people down for so long before they start thinking, maybe the system that is paying me low wages and giving me no health care for no reason that I can discern is not one that I'm okay with.
How discouraged would you be, Tim Barker, if Hillary and all her friends, columnists and otherwise, just blow Bernie away?
Well, it would be disappointing, of course, but I think that the significance of Sanders goes well beyond this election. You know, I think that if it were just a question of one primary, then no one would be interested in it. What Sanders is providing is a sort of just an opportunity for a lot of frustration that's been coalescing for a long time together. And I think that if you look at the numbers in Iowa and you look at the 70-80% of young voters opting for Sanders, that's not a group of people that's going to go away and that's going to be satisfied. So, you know, if we lose, we lose, but we keep organizing, we keep fighting.
Corey, who are you waiting to organize here? Who's ripe
to
be
organize?
Included? Yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of people who are, I mean, 58% of Americans polled said that they support universal health care, right? So there's a lot of people out there who are frustrated with so many aspects of the system, and I'm excited. I think this is great. Now is the time to get organized because the door has been kicked open. We can talk about socialism openly now. So let's talk about taxing the rich. Let's talk about closing the prisons. Let's talk about pulling the troops back and cutting the military budget and opening the borders. And I'm for I'm for really running with the new conversation, and now's our time.
You know, John Cassidy, who's a Scotsman who writes in The New Yorker, had a fascinating observation that what blew him away about the polls on Iowa was first that virtually half of the likely Democratic voters embraced the designation socialist for themselves, but furthermore that 88% of them described themselves as optimists. I have moments when I think this might be, you know, yeah, it's a dream, but it could be incredibly easy. I keep thinking of Dan Ariely, that very, very clever guy who wrote Predictably Irrational, thinks up marvelous questionnaires, but he has, you know, thousands of people took this test, you know, in a draw circle. Imagine the division of wealth among the five quintiles. People, when they're asked, are shocked. They can't believe how skewed the American income is. Furthermore, when they see a sort of gently, you know, proportional representation of incomes, you know, the rich are a little bit better off, but the poor aren't desperate. They pick that 90%. That is in other words, they don't know, but they're picking the Swedish distribution,
right,
of wealth and income.
Can I say something about that?
Please.
Because, you know, that it's good that studies like that diagnose the problem. And it's good that we're talking now about the disastrous healthcare system that we have. And it's good that we're talking about the police departments that are completely out of control. But beyond diagnosing the problem, when we're talking about solutions, that's where I actually feel hopeful, but it's a hope that lies outside of the current political situation we have. I do not have hope that the Democratic Party is going to express these hopes that are now kind of coming out in a groundswell. We've got to build something outside of that.
Tim, what do you think?
I agree that diagnosing the problem is not enough. And I think if you think back to what David Simon was saying, we can see that, right? He's very good on the diagnosis, you know, but he's very vague on the solution. All he has is a kind of backward-looking nostalgia for this time when things were good. But if you take seriously his diagnosis of the problem, if it's really the case that, you know, America's elite doesn't need a working class anymore, that there are these huge amounts of people with no value to the system, well then, you know, what do you do about that? We need solutions which are pretty far outside the realm of what's currently possible. So you asked about education earlier. I think a crucial part of socialist political education is taking ideas that seem crazy, that people don't talk about, and making them seem necessary and obvious. I think when we're talking about, you know, these populations in Baltimore and Flint, an idea like the guaranteed minimum income, which used to be talked about a lot, which Martin Luther King thought would be a great idea, you know, and then disappeared for decades, that's something people are talking about again now. And just for people who don't know, this would be a payment given to people, all adults, whether they work or not, to enable them to, you know, survive and put a life together, whether or not the system has an interest in them.
In the Department of Implementation, Todd Devine made an interesting observation to the Huffington Post the other day. He said, if Sanders got elected and Congress balked at his program, we will turn the midterm elections in 2018 into the largest referendum in the history of midterms. It's something Barack Obama never did. He was trying to bring folk together. Right. He's saying Sanders would try to, you know, throw the bums out.
Right.
Does that encourage you?
Honestly, I'll be totally honest. I really don't. When I think about politics, and I'm sure it's the same for Tim and Sarah, like politics is something that happens every day. It's every aspect of our lives. It isn't just something that happens once every 4 years. I mean, in the United States, politics is this incredibly passive thing where you're supposed to just do nothing for 4 years and then, you know, cast a vote on one day. And that's the kind of your greatest participation in democracy. And I reject the whole thing. So these problems are urgent. And I'm not concerned about the timescales of the 2018 midterm election. It's like, if we want to tax the rich, let's fight for that. If we want universal health care, let's fight for that. If we want to stop the police killings, let's fight for that right now.
Sarah Leonard, are you ready to run for office?
I think that there are actually better things for all of us to do with our time right now. And I think that what people should be doing is joining the social movements that already expanded the political imagination in this country to make something like Senator Sanders' run possible. And so I hope that that's what young people will do between now and whenever the next election is. I think that's how you expand the political imagination, not just with one campaign or another.
Sarah Leonard, thank you. Tim Barker and Corey Peterson-Smith in our studio, thank you. Thanks also to Thomas Frank and the great David Simon. You can find more of our conversations with David Simon and Thomas Frank on our website at radioopensource.org. This week's show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our campaign manager. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.